Welcome to Drinks Insider, the podcast that's interested in everything you can drink. If it's legal, if you can sell it, and more importantly, if you can make money from it, then we're going to talk about it. So come on this journey into the commercial world of everything drinkable. I'm your host, Felicity Carter, and you're listening to Drinks Insider. If you want to know about the realities of working in the beverage business, Adam Cost is the right man to ask. With more than two decades of experience behind him, he's done it all, from working in Vegas to working on brand innovation at some of the world's biggest companies like Heineken and Pernod Ricard. Today, he's a board advisor at the Centre for Beverage Education and Innovation at Johnson & Wales University. Plus, he's also just co-founded an agency called Heroes and Villains, which specialises in developing brand identities and strategies for non-alc, RTD, beer and spirits. If that wasn't enough, he's also developed an RTD called Dirty Shirley that's flying off the shelves. The secret to its success is great packaging plus fewer and better ingredients. But one of the reasons he's so interesting to talk to is because he doesn't shy away from talking about the difficulties involved in working in this sector. It's a great conversation, but please forgive my side of it. If I sound squeaky, it's because when I recorded it, I had a nasty case of COVID. As always, the takeaways will be in the newsletter, which you can sign up for at drinksinsider.com.
Hi, Adam. Great to see you.
Hi, Felicity. Great to see you.
Right, let's start. You have a very impressive, long-standing career in the beverage industry. So I read that you ran nightclubs into Vegas, you marketed global brands like Jameson. Can you talk a bit about your history in the beverage industry?
Yeah, I started out right outside of college, getting a management role with the Nine Group in Las Vegas, running some of the most popular nightclubs there at the time. And, you know, realized there was a lot more to the industry than kind of operating venues, and was fortunate enough to make a connection with the team at Heineken in San Diego. And after working for Marriott there a little bit, moved into a sales role. And that company really opened up the door for me to explore things like retail sales, distributor management, and eventually kind of promoting me to marketing roles in New York City, which kind of really, you know, catalyzed my career for long-term growth.
So you've really done everything. You've been inside every side of the business, basically.
I tried to learn it from the inside out, and kind of get your hands dirty in every aspect. So, you know, with the long-term vision of either leading a company or starting one. So everything kind of, you know, it's like it's like the guy who wants to be the dishwasher because he needs to see how that made. So, yeah, and I just had a great, you know, along the journey, you know, you don't do these things on your own. And I just had an incredible group of mentors along the way that gave me opportunities to.
So you have to tell me, what was it like as a young person working in nightclubs in Vegas?
It's way worse than it sounds.
Go on. How bad is it?
You're a glorified babysitter of human beings who are all having the time of their life, but you know, with putting 2,500 people on alcohol in one room is always a joy and an experience. But you know, we had an incredible team that made it as hard as it was, made it pretty fun.
Yeah, okay. I'd actually like to hear more about that. But okay, so your career does excuse my voice. Your career does include very large corporations like Heineken and AB InBev, and also startups like Waterloo Sparkling Water. What did you learn from working at huge enterprises that you think is transferable to startups?
I think it's the organizational skills, you know, having a clear mission of where you're trying to go with any sort of project, you know, getting really organized from a dollars and cents standpoint. You know, a lot of these organizations, especially Heineken, we were very focused on kind of what the ROI would look like. So it built a lot of discipline where, you know, when you kind of move down into more entrepreneurial roles and you're working with entrepreneurs in general, they can kind of be leading a lot more emotional, a lot more reactive, And it's not a bad thing either, because that's a competitive advantage in a lot of ways. But, you know, it really gave me the kind of perspective and balance of both sides of those opportunities to shape strategies, right? And every brand in a corporation has a different strategy, and every startup has a different strategy. So, you know, you just got to see a lot of ways that different brands and different business units within big companies operate.
Now, I'd really like to know about Waterloo Sparkling Water, because water actually fascinates me. How do you differentiate a brand of water? Tell me what strategies you do to make your water stand out in the market versus other waters. I mean, what are consumers looking for when they choose this water over that water?
Yeah, I think, you know, the best practice at Waterloo, and this was already existing when I came into the business, but it was, you know, the team had done an excellent job of identifying incrementality. They did not directly choose to go right at mainstream flavors and be another lime on the shelf, or be another, homogenous flavor, right? You see a lot of this in beverage where a category leader breaks out and then everybody else chases the same flavors, different brand, right? Well, you know, how are you going to get that consumer to convert? Because, you know, over time I developed the perspective that, you know, consumers, whether they like it or not, get anchored on flavors. And it may not be the best flavor, but it's the one they're anchored on that they tried the first. So
can you tease that out a little bit more? What do you mean get anchored? And how does that process start? Is it that where they enter, they get stuck on that and it's hard to move them, or it's just familiarity? Can you talk through the process?
Yeah, no real process. It's really kind of just what we see. The data kind of shows it. So it's tough to say what the consumer's mindset or journey is, but it's the idea that if you have a lime in the market, like for an example, like La Croix, right? Or LaCroix, whatever you want to call them. You know, they had a really strong lime product in the market, and that's what the consumer, based on multiple usages of that product, have developed a loyalty or familiarity with that flavor. So even if you launch another lime right next to it and your lime is objectively better, you know, who's to say, that consumer is going to automatically be like, well, I'm just going to go with what's familiar, right? Especially when you have parity in pricing and anything else, there's some safety in what you know, right? And so unless that profile of lime is truly dominant, you know, it's hard to separate that consumer from loyalty. We see that in other categories, like we saw it in White Claw, where just people couldn't penetrate that armor. And we see it with High Noon currently. They can't penetrate that armor. So, you know, Waterloo just came in with really distinct and incremental flavors. And they were able to get shelf space based on that and develop their own flavor loyalty on, you know, new flavors to the category.
I've heard so many beverage entrepreneurs say this, that in the end, the flavor matters, but it doesn't matter. You know, what really matters is the branding and so on. So
it all just matters.
If you were going to, if somebody came to you and said, here's a whole bunch of money and I've got water, launch it for me, how would you do it? How would you differentiate your water in the marketplace?
Oh, I'd give them their money back.
Would you? What if it was a huge amount of money, Adam? What if it was enough to change your life?
If I had that answer, you know, I would, again, I would pay them that money back to not get in a low margin business like water.
So, okay.
It's a tough one. I don't know. I think, you know, it's remarkable what companies like Liquid Death have done in a heavily commoditized market. And that would prove your previous person's hypothesis correct, that it is all about marketing. And that it is all about brand. And I think, you know, when you're dealing with, you know, what they've done, it truly is a masterclass in marketing.
Yeah, it's an amazing story. Okay, so on the topic of things that you would never get involved in, with your huge experience in beverages, what else wouldn't you touch? What do you think you'd stay well away from right now?
Oh, tequila. Just so
tequila.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, just too late. You know, too late to get into those things. You know, you look for categories and segments that have a lot of growth in them, but, you know, haven't reached that kind of gold rush saturation point. So, you know, you wouldn't touch vodka with a 10-foot pole, and because it's just really hard to differentiate and create distinction there.
So what are the signs that the category still has growth? What, when you look at it, you go, yeah, I'll, that one looks good. What are the sort of things you should look for?
Well, there's the data, but then there's you're looking for consumer behavior shifts, right? Like Waterloo was great because we saw lots of people running away from the carbonated soft drink industry and running towards healthier options and sparkling water and flavored sparkling water. So that's a long-term consumer behavior shift, which will provide growth to that flavored water segment for a long time. You know, when we look at spirits as an example, we see a huge drive of consumers demanding more flavor, convenience, and quality, which indicates, you know, that's a big consumer shift going towards ready-to-drink cocktails, right? So, you know, these are not just kind of fad trends where people are kind of interested in a space. These are long-term growth engines that are going to cannibalize existing spirits, wine, and beer categories, but then also recruit new consumers directly into them, into alcohol. So, you know, those things are very attractive. And then, you know, in regard to RTD, I like where it's at because you're seeing a lot of shakeout and contraction from brands that may have launched about 4 years ago when there was the gold rush moment, leaving more opportunity for higher quality innovation in the category more.
Okay, so tell me more about that. Is this that people have, you know, reached as much as they can do by themselves and they're selling, or is it people who are forced to sell and get out of it because they just haven't been successful? I mean, what's happening in that market?
I think the majority, unfortunately, is the latter.
And if you look at who succeeded and who didn't, and we'll talk about your products in a second, but if you look at who didn't succeed, what did they do wrong?
You know, it's an arms race, right? Because they all had, I think in the early days of RTD, everyone had similar flavor profiles. Everyone had cool brands. Everybody had great products, you know, but it really came down to the resources that the brands had available and their ability to create a distinctive positioning in the market versus a category leader that could outgun them. So I think that causes a lot of shakeout. So it's a, you know, it's a tough one where you want to compete, you move fast, you create a good product, but either the brand doesn't resonate or you don't have the resources to sustain the business.
Well, speaking of resources, you worked on one of the most sort of iconic campaigns, The Most Interesting Man in the World. Can you talk about how that was conceived and give us the story about that?
Yeah, I wasn't there when it got started. But I know our internal team at Heineken at the time got this really wild idea from one of our creative agencies and felt really strongly that the brand needed something, you know, to take a big shot. And, you know, there was an insight within kind of the millennial community, young Gen X millennial consumer, you know, around kind of the fear of living a boring life. That was really kind of what this consumer kind of universally was thinking at the same time. And at that same time, 2008 had hit kind of a generation really hard, and there was a lot of insecurity going on with that consumer base. And they were primed and ready for some sort of mentor, right? And beer advertising at that time was fairly predictable and boring. It was either heavy comedy or it was girls. And, you know, they just had this wild idea and they had to fight for it. It was pretty quickly after the merger between CCM and Heineken from Mexico. And they really had to fight for it. And there was a head of marketing at the time, Willem van der Hoeven, who just went to battle and, you know, at some point he said, do it, but it's your head. And so he went forward and it's, you know, probably one of the best gambles of all time.
Yeah, it's interesting. You know, having worked on creative campaigns, often you can come up with something great and then all the stakeholders inside the client get more and more worried about it. They agree it's great, but somebody says, what about this? And what about this? And by the time it's been through the process, often it's killed it. It's actually really hard to get those great big campaigns up and running. So was that because the time was right to take creative risks, do you think? Was the market in such a state of disarray that it, you know, somebody needed to do that?
No, I think at that time, Mexican imports were really going on a run and there was a bit of a race. You know, Heineken had just kind of they saw the value of imports in general. Heineken was doing really well at the time, but Mexican imports in general were really starting to grow, and Corona was just on fire and becoming a real challenge to compete with. So they needed to take a shot somewhere, because they had, you know, three core brands, which was, you know, Dos Equis, Sol, and Tecate. Tecate being kind of more primarily Hispanic. And so they needed that mainstream brand to really break out across the country, where it already had strong success in Southern California and Texas. And they were like, okay, well, there's market validation that this thing can go. Now, how do we scale it across the U.S.? So it was really a category growth. It's like, well, it's, you know, I think there was a guy that said it was, you know, quote, it said, you know, there's the risk of what if you do, but what's the bigger risk of what if you don't?
That's right. Yeah. All right. So let's go back to talking about the RTD market. What specific factors or trends in RTD led you to believe it was the ideal space to launch a new brand?
Well, we had a brand called Country Lua that we launched back in 2021, and we did exactly what I talked about. I mean, I learned from my mistake. We launched a brand with amazing liquids, but the attributes were, you know, of a liquid standpoint, were parity to category leaders. And we thought, because it was super, you know, we positioned it as more premium. Now, consumers will easily trade up. This is a premium category. But, you know, loyalty on price and product is a very real thing. And first to market advantage and first to scale advantage is a very real thing. And so, but we love this space because for me personally, it blended my spirits background, my beer background, my sparkling water background, all in one. So, like, oh, this is perfect for my background and the things I enjoy doing. And, you know, really love creating convenient, high quality beverages. So this was really fun for me. And, you know, there was less competition at that point in time when we entered the market. And then within a year, holy moly, everybody was in it. White Claw came in. Like, you know, everybody was right on top of us. So it became a thing. But we were also watching really great brands do their thing, like Long Drink and Lone River Ranch Water in the agave seltzer space. And we were like, man, those guys just broke out without big budgets, without big resources, and they created just really distinct positioning and products in the marketplace. We loved it. We thought that was a huge best practice. And that gave us the confidence to pivot and continue the game.
Adam, go back a step. Who's the we you're talking about?
Me and my investor community, my advisors, our distributors.
Okay. So how did you end up launching a brand in the first place? Did you think to yourself, I've got a really great idea, and then approach investors? Did people in approach you and say, hey, you're the guy to do something? How did it all work?
Well, it was first based on stupidity. And then, you know, then we
many
had
great things have been.
So, I'm fortunate enough to have a family member, my cousin Anson, who's an incredible designer. We actually just launched a small creative consultancy agency called Heroes and Villains. Mm-hmm. We just went to work. I kind of creative directed the vision of the project, and then his amazing skill set was able to bring it to life. And then partnerships fell in, like our flavor company was willing to do some free R&D for us to get liquids developed. And
that's really interesting. What made them do that? Was it because your project was so interesting and novel and they wanted to work on it? I mean, mostly companies don't offer to work for free. Why were they interested in doing that?
It was a beautiful brand. The liquid concepts were fun and interesting. And then, you know, I think a lot of these guys, they wanted to work with, you know, founders who, you know, have a track record of success. So that's me kind of bragging about myself a little bit, but not intentionally. But I think it's who they get to work with, right? So if you're someone who comes off the street with very little domain expertise, you're going to be challenged from a partnership, from a distributor side, from a vendor side, all over the place, because you unfortunately don't have a lot of experience in the industry. And that's not to say that there aren't wildly successful people that have overcome all those challenges. I just saw it as an entrepreneur as a harder place to start.
So did you already have those investors lined up? Were these people you'd already worked with, or did you go out and seek investment?
Yeah, we went out and sought it. So just friends, family, fools.
Right. So this isn't massive VC investment. This is okay. And how did you convince your family and friends to give you money?
Showed them the business plan. This is what we'll be able to do. And of course, there's the again, track record of success, kind of a domain expertise in the industry. Yeah. You know, some of them were concept agnostic. They were just like, we just believe in you. Mm. And so that's always really nice when people are willing to back you for you. And they're like, I don't care what you do. We bet on you, which is really nice and generous. And a lot of people also in collaboration just love the brand and loved what we were going to do.
Well, I took a look at it. It's fantastic design. It's got that lovely sort of nostalgic element to it. Was that deliberate? Were you tapping into nostalgia?
You're talking Country Luau or Dirty Shirley?
Oh, I should say Dirty Shirley, but yeah. Well, actually, let's talk about that. So, what happened to Country Luau? When did you decide, okay, this doesn't work, and what made you decide this doesn't work?
Yeah, kind of at the end of or beginning of 23. You know, I consider myself a pretty decent marketer, and you know, all the tools and things that we threw at it just weren't creating repeat purchase. We were able to get a really good trial, but we weren't getting repeat. And, you know, the problem with that is that you can keep expanding, you can keep pushing distribution, you can keep investing in marketing, but your marketing efficacy over time mathematically is starting to become less effective. Mm-hmm. And what I call it, it was a zombie in that it was eating. It was consuming, it was really hungry, and it could keep moving and going forward, but it was not alive.
There's a lot of those businesses in the wine industry, actually, except often they don't realize they're zombies. So do you know why you weren't getting repeat purchases? It was just too hard against the incumbents, or people want novel things? Do you know why?
No, it's so hard. You know, once they've created kind of that, you know, that seltzer loyalty, it's just so hard to create, you know, to steal that pie, right? Why you, right? You have to have a really strong connection with a consumer to why you versus them, especially when you're maybe a couple dollars higher, your flavors are a bit more esoteric. Because we, you know, I chose to do a little bit more esoteric flavors and some more fanciful names. Which were a little bit more challenging for consumers probably to have craveability on.
Can you give me some examples?
We did a beautiful yuzu ranch water, right? Ranch water craze is going crazy across the country at the time. I loved kind of the, you know, we had a tropical brand in Country Luau that lended itself to tropical flavors, which I was really a big fan of, which in Nielsen, those flavors were really trending up. And we chose an esoteric flavor like yuzu, which is beautiful in execution. It's kind of like a lemon and a grapefruit had a baby. And just super refreshing seltzer flavor. But yuzu was a challenging flavor for consumers to understand. What is it? What does it taste like? So when you're not, you know, in a sampling environment or a demo environment, how does that consumer look at the 50 options on the shelf and be like, I'm going to gamble my money today on yuzu?
Mm. Well, actually, you've just said when you're not in a sampling environment, why weren't you in a sampling environment? Isn't that a key factor in beverage sales?
Sure, but you can't be in that environment all day.
When you were, when people had a chance to try it, did they have a different response to it?
Loved it. Loved it. Conversion rates were like above 75%. But sampling is expensive and not scalable, and, you know, it's a... It's very, very expensive, and oftentimes, most of the time, upside down. So it's a loss on every sampling event, unless you sell 10 cases for RTD. Yeah.
So it's actually very brave. Most entrepreneurs are very emotionally wedded to things, and a lot of people find it very hard to say this isn't working and shut it down. What was the moment that you thought I'm going to move on to something else?
Well, we had line extended Dirty Shirley, and we kind of created a similar packaging to where we're at now, but kind of spun it off onto its, you know, a little different format than Country Luau. And I was like, okay, well, we were in Nashville at the time, and we did a super small production run on it. And we put it out on the table during sampling events versus Country Luau. So you had to kind of split the table. And people would walk up to the table, and they would be like, look at Country Luau, they'd be like, interesting. And then they would look at Dirty Shirley and they would basically throw themselves on the floor. So we were like, okay, there's something different here. This is creating an almost instant emotional connection with consumers, and that they found the liquid to also be, you know, to over deliver on quality and flavor and be the right balance of sweetness and ABV. And it seemed to just be calibrated. And then what we loved about it is that every consumer that stood in front of our table started telling their own Dirty Shirley or Shirley Temple story from their childhood. So at that point, we knew we had a brand that transcended just, hey, tastes good, looks good, and had the ability to really create an emotional connection with consumers, which from a marketer's perspective, you know, we like to think that it drives loyalty.
Go back a step to how you developed it in the first place and why you decided on that particular drink. What was the inspiration for it?
In 22, it had gone viral on TikTok and was being kind of pushed through the media pretty well. We started looking at consumers and how they engaged with it on social media, who the consumer was and what kind of tribe they were part of. And we kind of looked at that audience a little bit closer, and we realized there was really a big gap in the market serving that consumer segment. And that was really kind of this Gen Z consumer, looking for things that are nostalgic and kind of make them feel better and then also require better ingredients. And we were like, okay, well, there's nothing really competing on that space, maybe outside a long drink, but really that was really male focused time. And we were like, well, there's also something just really special about the Shirley Temple and how it's part of the DNA of the American consumer's life already. And there's already saliency around that type of product. And those are things that, you know, when you're a broke entrepreneur, without a lot of venture capital money, you look for these things that you can leverage and scale. And so we knew we already had a pre-existing positive relationship with consumers. And how many times are there in the industry where you can do that? Very, very rare. You know, generally costs a lot of money to build a brand. But if, you know, that relationship that a consumer has with a product that they're fond of and they understand the usage occasions of, which are generally celebratory and treating yourself, which are indulgent the same as alcohol, you know, that's a place I thought we could play and play really efficiently.
So it sounds like you were watching TikTok, watching the trends. Is that something that you do?
Yeah. I mean, if you're a marketer, you've got to be in touch with the pulse of the consumer. You can't rely on an agency all the time to come and give you a presentation about what the consumer is doing. You got to know it. And then as an entrepreneur, you're flying really low. You know, when I was in the bigger marketing organizations, we would sit in the tower, right? But when you're an entrepreneur, you're on the street, you're talking to consumers, it's hand-to-hand combat. You're talking to retailers. Your insights are, you know, immediate. You don't need to do, you know, paid research to kind of get to the good stuff really fast.
Well, you had two insights there. One was the drink, but the other one was the nostalgia. So what is it about nostalgia, about this moment in time that people are looking for?
The world's in a rough spot. You know, it's a challenging time to live, right? Whether it's social media pressure of showing you everything that you should be, right? And the pressure that this consumer is under by comparing themselves to others, or just the world in general, beverages just need to bring joy, light, and connectivity to consumers' lives. You know, as proven by the contentious experience Bud Light had, kind of, you know, again, reminding me as a marketer and entrepreneur, the role that beverages play in life is not political. It's about joy, and it's about bringing people together and enhancing life's most memorable moments. And, you know, what does that better than a boozy Shirley Temple? I don't know. I haven't found anything else that where I could be like, that just hits.
That Bud Light campaign was so disastrous. Given your extraordinary background in beverages at all levels, do you think they could have done anything to rescue that situation, or did everything, or was it just lost?
I don't know. I thought of ways to maybe resurrect it. I think it was just a challenging place to be, and a, you know, something that hit on a subject matter that was really sensitive at the time in the U.S. And, you know, they tripped the wrong wire, and, you know, it's tough to dig out from that, because you would inevitably, to appease one audience, you alienate the other. They were really in a pickle.
Let's go back to what you were doing right at the time. Okay, so how did you formulate it? Because I understand that you reduced the ingredients, and the ingredients you use are really high quality ingredients. So what was the process of creating it?
Just went back to our flavor company that we had already partnered with and said, this is what we want to do. And I think what we looked at is we were looking at a lot of data around consumer preference and this propensity of wanting, you know, things like real ingredients, real juice, you know, this sense of a higher quality product, right? And then we kind of looked around the category and we were like, okay, there's no, you know, what's the juice in High Noon? What's the juice in this? What's the juice in that? They never kind of come out and state it, right? So we have a hunch what type of juice it is. And does the consumer know? And furthermore, do they really care? But for us to kind of just do a real juice claim on something like a Dirty Shirley, it needed to be in line with flavors that you would find in a traditional Shirley Temple, because in our opinion, you know, it still needed to be an authentic tasting product. It still needed to deliver against the original. And our best path forward was finding ingredients that gave it both a natural color, supported the flavor design of the original, and created a cost-effective, you know, base platform to do innovation off of.
And how much did you test all of the elements? Did you go out and test it on consumers when you were developing it, or was the finished product the one you took to market?
Yeah, we tested it amongst ourselves. And then we also have a creative agency that we use for our social media that consists of about 50 consumer targets. And so we have the benefit of this kind of awesome focus group that we can kind of bring it to and be like, what do you think? And yeah, they gave us kind of direct and honest feedback. And then also, you know, you do a pilot run and you tweak and you do a pilot run and you tweak. And so you're always going to do iterations, because what we found early on is that the liquid was a little too light, mm-hmm. a little not flavorful enough. And so we added sugar and we added more juice and we added a little bit more flavor and we boosted the thing up. And then we also discovered that they still wanted more flavor and they wanted more alcohol. So we're like, oh, well, we can't satisfy everyone. So about 30% of our audience wanted a stronger product. So we came out with Extra Dirty.
Oh, great. And I mean, the packaging is so distinctive. It's really great design. Did you also test that, or did you do the design and go, yeah, that's it?
No, we knew. We knew right away. So I think it took us, you know, generally creative rounds on packaging can take you kind of over up to like a dozen rounds. And I think at round two, we had it and we were just like, that's it. And very few times in my career, I've been like, that's it, done. And so we just got it done super fast. It was just like, wow. And then we started showing it to distributors and people and everybody was like, oh my God, that's so cool.
Now, I take it that these are distributors that you already had existing relationships with from your background, so you're not going in cold. They already know who you are. But even so, how difficult was it to get listings of a brand new product?
We were really lucky to develop large partnerships with the folks at Southern Wine and Spirits pretty fast. And then as we, you know, went to markets where they weren't available as a partner, everyone just saw the value in the brand, saw the strategy, saw the packaging, tasted the liquid. And I think if you have all those elements, plus you're distinct and incremental to the category that they want to compete in, it was pretty easy for us. I think, you know, the challenges came that we did experience on Country Luau's. We were cool brand, same product. Cool brand, same product is something that they were already hyper-focused on. So why would they add a parity competitor to the market unless you have something that's a real catalyst like a celebrity or massive amounts of money?
And the answer was, why did they take it on?
Dirty Shirley? Oh, it was distinct and incremental.
It was unique. Okay. So everybody's goal is to get a listing with somebody like Southern Glazer. But what does that mean? So when they distribute it, how big is the initial distribution? Do they put it in test markets or do they roll it out wherever?
You go through a process with them to, evaluate. You basically tell them what your plans are and they kind of will either come back against your requests or they'll ask for the product in certain markets. And so we were lucky enough to get a blend of both of markets that we really wanted to be in and some incremental markets.
So which one were your first markets? Where did it go first?
With them, I think we went out to like Florida and Western Tennessee. And
Western Tennessee. Okay.
Western Tennessee. They only have distribution in Western Tennessee. Ohio, Missouri, Pennsylvania, Indiana, California, some great markets. So
what's your favorite market? What's the place that you go and you go, yeah, this is cool?
Oh, they're all my favorite. I can't pick one.
Of course they are. And so how long before people went, yeah, this is working really, really well? And how soon before you had to begin scaling it?
I think we're still in that process. I think, Dirty Shirley, for all extensive purposes, is only about a year and a half old at this point from a launch standpoint. And we really only launched on our broader network since April. So we're still, we have not arrived at all. I will never kind of put a flag in the ground and say we've arrived. But, we're on a well over a $2 million run rate for the brand. And we've got, about 3,000 stores across the country. And
okay, that's pretty good.
Our velocities are improving month over month. Our IRI data is on fire. And, we continue to be able to, deepen partnerships with companies like Walmart and Meijer and Total Wine and Specs across the country. So, and Albertsons divisions are jumping in all over the place. And retail partners see the value in the brand as well. So, that's the.
And how much marketing do they expect you to do to support the brand in store?
They have no expectation on marketing. Just you've got to perform. So it's up to you to decide the level of marketing that you want to do that will drive the velocities to stay. They love to see your marketing plans and know that you're doing something. And they have some requirements along the way, but for the most part, it's up to you. To your call.
Okay. And what's your strategy? Is it PR-led? Is it social media? Is it influencer-led? What do you do?
Yeah, we have media partnerships with the folks at 10 p.m. Curfew, which help drive big brand awareness. And then we also, have overperformed on social media on Instagram and TikTok. So we drive a ton of organic social. We do some paid media, but not a lot. And we really rely on that plus, price and promotion and trade spend.
Yeah. I mean, using TikTok for alcohol is quite new in the US. Am I right about that?
Yeah. Yeah. It was regulated by TikTok. We went early on it.
So you're catching the upswing of alcohol brands on TikTok. Can people buy directly from TikTok or is that still not allowed?
No, not alcohol, but we have some really great merchandise that's available for consumers. So that's a way that we can still be relative and advertise cool stuff that consumers are interested in on the platform.
And are you doing all of the TikTok work yourself or is it that other people are taking the brand and they're talking about it for you?
We get a blend. It was so surprising kind of in the early days of Dirty Shirley to see thousands and thousands and thousands of women, young women want to join the brand. And want to work with the brand, whether for compensation or just for product. But there was an immediate, love for it, which I haven't seen very often in my career.
And how do you decide, I'll work with you, I won't work with you? What's your criteria? Because TikTok doesn't necessarily, it's not necessarily the number of followers you've got.
Right. It's organic. Right. So or it's their algorithm. If you trip the algorithm, you can get a lot of reach, organic reach, in the millions sometimes. which has, you know, the incredible value. You know, it just, you have to kind of look at the person's ability to kind of create, right? And do they fit the brand? Do they have their own ideas that are authentic to kind of them and their audience? Versus someone who's just going to maybe repeat something that you already did on your platform. And there's probably more of that out there in the influencer world than true kind of like really high quality creators that can create kind of their own distinct expression of the brand and do something unique that'll pop and go.
Have you worked out how to trip the algorithm? I mean, I think everybody in alcohol is trying to work this out. Have you got any insights into how to go viral on TikTok?
Shots on goal. Just take a lot of shots.
Yeah, unfortunately. All right. So in some of your previous interviews, you've stressed the importance of margin management, especially for young founders. What specific KPIs do you track?
We definitely track gross profit margins. We track freight efficiency like a dog.
Is that right?
Oh, yeah. Well, that's a variable. You know, you always, I think, from a financial standpoint, want to be ruthless about your variable costs, right?
Can you explain that to me? I've got no idea. How do you track your freight efficiency? What are you looking for?
Well, simply from a managerial accounting standpoint, you have an estimate of what freight should cost, what market averages are, and are you getting those prices? You know, and as you start to build beverage companies out, you unfortunately have to ship things further and further away from your production point. So you then need to start looking at alternative options to stage project or product at demand points across the country.
Right. So you might actually have multiple places where you start producing it. Oh, that's really interesting.
That's the goal in this co-manufacturing world, is to diversify operations as close to the core business areas as possible to limit freight.
Okay. Any other insights into things you should keep an eagle eye on?
Freight's a killer in beverage. Yeah. Other ones, you know, cost of ingredients, you know, who your partners are from CAM perspective. I mean, you just want to build really strong partnerships across the board. And how fast can you get better terms on ingredients, and as well as, you know, accounts payable, you know, who will give you the best terms there. Because the cash conversion cycle in beverage is ruthless. It's just terrible. So it's long.
Yeah. I mean, something I've talked to a lot of entrepreneurs about is that at the moment of growth can be a moment of real crisis, because you've got to start paying for the product, but it can be a long time before you get paid. How do you plan for that, or how do you manage that?
There's really no magic solution. It's just having enough cash on hand to manage the business, or, you know, making sure that you're very, very diligent about making sure your partners pay on time. And that can be very tedious.
Yeah.
Because there's all sorts of tricks in the game, and, you know.
Such as?
Unfortunately, you also have to communicate to your vendors, you know, like, listen, I'm not going to pay you on time because of these factors. I got to get paid by my partners to pay you. And you just have to have really strong relationships with these vendors and ensure that you have vendors who are going to have your back during these phases where you grow. Because the other option is build a war chest of cash and dilute your business and give away equity. Like, that's option two. You know, you have to just be really mindful of all those factors.
Okay. So, I mean, this is a really interesting question. How do you get people to accept the fact that they're going to have to wait to be paid? Is that based on the fact that you've got very long-standing relationships and they trust you? Or, you know, how do you negotiate that?
It's always trust. Trust, transparency, communicating timing, you know, not running away from paying bills, but hitting it head on and being very direct about what you need. You know, a lot of these are major, major companies. Us not paying our bill as a small company for a short period of time isn't going to sink them. So generally in this growth phase, there should be some tolerance for your ability to slow pay if you need to.
Just going back a step earlier, you talked about, you know, you look a lot at the data and the research. What data and research do you look at? Because it can be quite hard in alcohol to find really good data.
The Nielsen IQ stuff is really great. And then we're fortunate enough to have partners, you know, that are able to share some proprietary data with us. I won't tell the sources, but, you know, you got to find some of those outliers and business partners who can get you the good stuff. A lot of data, unfortunately, is all historical. So it only tells you where you're at today. It has no bearing on tomorrow because tomorrow is completely unknown. So, you know, it's arbitrage. Data is arbitrage and everybody has it. And, you know, it's not, data is not a competitive advantage. It just gives you knowledge of what not to do in the past. So what to do in the future is really the insights that you're able to generate from talking with your distributors, talking with your customers, talking with consumers, looking at social media. Those are the things that will give you the competitive advantage in the future.
Okay, so there's a lot of would-be entrepreneurs who listen to this podcast. If you were talking to somebody who's aspiring to break into, say, the RTD market, what advice would you give them on do's and don'ts?
Just don't do it.
Okay, that's clear.
Just stay away.
Run far away.
Yeah, it's like anything. It's not exclusive to RTD. It's just a philosophy based on a history of making a lot of mistakes. You know, I finally learned, you know, the right approach to building brands in any kind of CPG space is you just have to be super distinct and have your own position. And, you know, the product needs to do that. The product needs to have a clear purpose and reason why it exists. It could be something historical like a Dirty Shirley. It could be something new that is just super kind of interesting and relevant. But it needs to be distinct. And, you know, there's a philosophy around, is distinct disruptive or is disruptive distinct? And a lot of people want to create really disruptive concepts, but there's no real history of the consumer enjoying these concepts. And so they just may not fit a broader market. And all I know in beverage is that you need to have scale for any of this stuff to work mathematically, to do it really well, to afford you the joys of profitability at some point.
Dare I ask, what's the worst mistake you've ever made? What's the one that you look back and go, oh, I'm never doing that again?
Oh, no, I don't have a single one that comes out. because, you know, at the end of the day, if you have the perspective that, you know, like the book, you know, the obstacle is the way, all these mistakes happen for a reason. If you really want to wax poetic about it, I learned from them and I won't make them again. And thank God none of them were, critical mistakes that sunk the company or stopped us from growing or lost us a customer. But I mean, man, we've made a lot of them along the way. And, you know, the only thing I know as an entrepreneur with over 20 years of beverage experience is I know less today than I did yesterday. Yeah. And that's every day. So you eat a lot of humble pie in this journey. And, you know, we're not even close to getting, you know, for it to be done. We have incredible early success and a wealth of opportunity in front of us.
Okay. Where to next? Where do you see the opportunities?
It's going deeper with, our partners, right? So, you know, whether it's our grocery retailers or mass retailers or distributors, you know, it's expanding in the right places now at the right time. And then, you know, for us as a brand like Dirty Shirley, you know, a lot of people will say, why don't you go, you know, deeper and wider in fewer markets. But with a brand like Dirty Shirley, it has the opportunity to reach saliency very quickly. And you need to be able to explore that on a national basis. So we'll still fight for national distribution, cementing ourselves as, you know, the Dirty Shirley of the United States of America. And we'll continue to move fast and aggressively along that journey.
All right. So finally, is there anything I haven't asked you about being a beverage entrepreneur that you think is important?
You know, if someone's looking to get into it, ask us about how we sleep at night.
apart from don't do it. Anything else?
No, I mean, I, it feels like you're asking for advice or what I would give to the audience.
Yes, that's exactly what I'm doing.
Yeah, You know, my best advice to anybody who's a seasoned entrepreneur or young entrepreneur is just be very honest with yourself about what you have, right? And you can believe in what you have all day, but you have to be very honest about it, as we were with Country Luau, unfortunately. Mm. And really, you know when the right time to pivot is, right? Don't pivot out of panic. Pivot out of like, we pivoted out of like, we have something remarkably better. And that requires 100% of our focus to be successful. We can't run two brands.
No, it's still, I still come back to the fact it's quite a ballsy decision, because a lot of people get trapped in the sunk cost fallacy of, well, I've put this much into it, so I better continue. I mean, it's actually really brave and honest to say, no, I'm going to cut this and do this thing instead.
I had the luck of having a really good professor during my MBA program who just really drove that sunk cost fallacy in business, like right out the door. And he's like, numbers are numbers. Mm. Look at it. He's like, if it's ugly, it's ugly. Like, you can't love ugly. You can't fall too in love with your business or the project, right? You've got to be really honest with about it. And a lot of entrepreneurs, you know, they make up and listen, I was mentally at this point, at one point in time, it was like, we're just going to run this to the last dollar till it's over. And they don't ever get that courage to pivot. And that can be driven by, you know, investors who are like, this is what we invested. We definitely had investors saying, like, why are you doing this? What about Country Luau? And I'm like, trust me. And they're like, okay, let's go. But you'll get it from everywhere. People who love the brand, a customer that loves the brand, a distributor. Like, we had one distributor. We were selling 3,000 cases a year, Country Luau, at this distributor, which is great, in a city. And we were like, we're killing it. And they're like, what? They're like, do you know how many companies would love to sell that much product in one market in a year? And we were like, yeah, sorry. This is where we're putting our resources.
All right. On that note, thank you very much. I've really enjoyed the conversation, Adam.
Thank you for having me. Appreciate it.
You've been listening to Drinks Insider, the podcast that explores the intersection of beverages and commerce. Now, if you would like a summary of this episode, sign up for the Drinks Insider newsletter, which sends you the takeaways. Just go to drinksinsider.com and add your name. And if there's something you think we should be talking about, drop me a line at felicity@drinksinsider.com. And before you go, please don't forget to rate this podcast. 5 stars are most welcome.